This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're still on remote. Y.S. Fing is here. He's the author of a new book, Perdition, which is part of a three-volume piece, and this is fashioned after Dante's Inferno, and it is a magnificent work. It is three-line stanzas of rhyme, but he does write about many other things. So Fing is going to say hi with another poem.
Thank you. This one is called Upon the Buddha for the Garden of My Mind. Here below the window in the rain, in the snow, you are practicing culture. Granite, self-enduring temperate winter, shoeless, foodless, disturbing the squirrels. I think of the story of Jesus, I think of virgin births and miracles, walking on wine, forgiving Judas, eternally upon the cross, the martyr, nailed there, tormented, bleeding, the pity, given by God to redeem sin and offer everlasting life. I think of the prohibition of representation of Muhammad, the warrior faceless on his steed, smiting, cudgeling the myriad infidel. He cannot be drawn, so symmetry takes the place of the symbol, complex and reifying, a mystery provoking obeisance. But there you remain in the shade. The sun will slant upon you, and I share my knowledge with you, and you show me the path I believe I will follow.
That is beautiful. You are a practicing Buddhist.
I tell people I'm a bad Buddhist.
There's no other kind.
I'm not a vegetarian. That to me is the line. If I to that point, I might feel more comfortable saying so.
Well, what brought you into that practice?
Well, I have always been interested, and when I gave up Catholicism, which I was raised on, I really felt the need to look into other religions. So I've read the Quran and as many of the Hadith as I can take, and lived in Thailand and came across Buddhism there and just continued to dig in. I lived in Japan for 4 years, and I have to say that manga and Osamu Tezuka were the ones who really introduced me to Buddhism. I highly recommend his series.
Please give us another poem.
Of course. This one, really just a mystical self-assessment. Mystical and not self. Self, the mysterious mystic, escaping definition, always being in motion, yet sitting still very fast, not yet there, devoted to awareness of the oneness of self with everything else, the unity of our myths toward the center and out, how to face adversity, to persevere with courtesy against the blindness of deafness and death, the self, lasting, indescribable quest, union, vanity persists, madness, the cusp of dread and a tipping cup, surface tension pressing, not a pleasant experience on the surface, but at the bottom of deep breath awaits, as from a dark cooling well, the release and the connection, a mouse and an elephant, a grain of sand and a black hole. The order is apparent, yet there is no self, so there is no self.
From the bottom well of the deep breath. Yes. And you know, you write political poems, you write Buddhist poems, you write spiritual poems, you write music. You do so much. How is that all in one brain? And does it come out in different poems, or is it blended, do you think, in your work?
Well, I think, in all honesty, I do a lot of things because I started as a poet. I think the idea of poetry for me very young was I'm going to be a rock and roll singer, and so I need to have lyrics. That transitioned shortly after the dream fell apart into poetry. And it really just became a practice of self-expression and examination and reflection and all those, you know, psychological things that we need to do.
Self-reflection, all those good things. Yeah. But you do use Buddhism to teach. You're a, at the University of Maryland teaching composition. How do you use that as the rubric to teach how to read and write?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole idea that I approach composition with is organization of thought. I tell my students it's called English because we're communicating in English, but in fact, we're helping you to organize your thinking. And Buddhism can be such a help in that regard. And so what I do in my classes is I introduce this textbook called What the Buddha Taught. It was by a man named Walpola Rahula, who wrote the book in 1959. And it's a very simple 8-chapter introduction to the Buddhist teachings. And when the students see that this person organized his brain in this way, then they see a path that they can follow. And, you know, whether they do or not, who knows?
What a marvelous thing. And the bonus is they might just get still. Yeah. They might just get quiet. They might just get serene, as well as knowing how to start a paragraph. Let's hear another poem. This is Y.S. Thing.
This is called Processes of Accretion. Processes of accretion, some denial, some indulgence, some resentment, some grace, some desire, some satiation, some pride, some humility, layered like a palimpsest, the displacement of knowledge, something withdrawn, something injected, waves crashing, recede, children born, grandparents die, ice melts, water flows, leaves fall, biodegradation, circles that cycle helicularly, the direction of all motion towards cessation, stone and blood, carbon and bone, clay and ash, and there you are.
You sure covered it. You sure covered it. Why do you use a pseudonym? Mm. Why do you use a pseudonym Thing when you do have another quite proper name?
Yes. I would say that the real moment for me as a writer for the public happened when I was about 34, 35 years old. And I came across the Tristram Shandy written by Lawrence Stern. And Stern adopted a couple of different identities in that book, Tristram Shandy himself, and also a parson named Yorick. And I thought that was a neat idea. And I adopted the nom de plume just to separate myself a little bit more from the writing. It wasn't about me anymore. It really was about, you know, communicating to the world.
And you did study at the Boston University, right? And Portland State University. And so is that where you majored in English?
I got my master's at Portland State, and my great teacher there was Tony Wolk. He's been there a long time. He's just great. And he taught me Dante's Divine Comedy. And he told me that I could write a scholarly paper if I wanted to, or else I could respond in any way that I felt would work.
You know, God love our professors who tell us we're allowed to do something.
Yes.
And darned if you didn't. Well, let's hear another kind of poem from your poetry wallet. I know you talk about your children. You talk about many things. So let us hear another part of you.
Okay, so this is an attempt to distill Michel Foucault's Panopticon.
You have to say who that is. Foucault.
Yeah, Michel Foucault is a philosopher, 60s, 70s, 80s, from France. Really, anybody who has studied a master's degree in the liberal arts will have encountered him. But his idea of the Panopticon is essentially, we have structured our institutions so that there is power communicated between those who have it and those who don't. And a lot of people see it as a very threatening thing, but I wanted to interpret it to my kids as something that gave them power. So this is actually two sonnets, if I may. And it's called Foucault's Panopticon for Kids. Discipline means learning how to learn, being willing to practice and improve, accepting admonition and adversity, recognizing failure and trying again, having fun working hard and sharing without thought for the promise of reward. The promise is too much, the reward too little. Because internalizing the processes and allowing discipline to become the frame, the skeleton with which action is taken, the rational enduring center of virtue to be established, then future happiness, in whatever form it may consist for you, will be prepared for hard times as well. And the second one. Hard time will begin with the one you love and reverberate out to identity and faith. It will be difficult to know who to trust among the sharks of all corrupted society, waiting to be validated among mediocrity and eaten alive in part for the experience. But then finding there is no objective value in the romantic perversity of youth, still being desirous to believe, however vain, you must find the will to return to calm, which is performed over time with patterned efficiency and sustainability, is the purpose of discipline, and the reward for hard work is more hard work.
Well, I think you pulled out the best of him. He was certainly controversial.
He's intimidating, I agree, but I really do prefer to see his ideas as a way to empower individuals in their quest, both for identity and a place in society.
Well, you have chosen the good in him, really, and that is the heart. It's the institution fashioning the individual, and you're all about getting the individual to be in charge.
Yeah, well, Grace, aren't you that way too? Aren't you a teacher who wants to open up other people?
What else is there?
I agree.
What's the alternative?
I love you.
You said you had a poem about your children. Am I pulling something on you?
I have one about the family. Those two were really the kid-oriented ones.
Okay, then we can stop there.
Okay.
Have you ever actually taught Foucault with those poems?
No, I haven't. Oh. I just recently sent them to my kids. You know, I wrote them when they were like 14 and 16 years old. I didn't give the poems to the kids then, but I just did like 2 weeks ago as I was preparing for this show.
And what do they say?
They haven't said anything yet.
That's typical. I mean, I think my children think of my poet brain as different from the one that's in the kitchen. Yeah. They don't want to mix them up.
They don't want to take me too seriously.
They don't want to go there. No, but we do. And Y.S. Fing is a light in our city and in our culture. And he has undertaken the boldest task I have known of in years. It was to take Dante and fashion a book about the Inferno in present day terms, taking on cultural figures, taking on political issues, and doing it all in three line stanzas that rhyme. Now, you said this is part of a greater volume.
Well, yeah. What I ended up doing in response to Tony Wolk's instruction at Portland State was writing the beginning of Fing's journey into perdition, into Inferno, into the lost world. And the idea was I was going to take Dante's ideas and apply them in an American milieu. And I say Dante's ideas, really, I should say his architecture. I felt like he created the building in which I could put all of these events. And so...
And they are a lot of events. How long did this take you in the making? It is a masterwork.
Yeah, thank you. It took a year. It's 3,614 lines long. Each section is essentially 1,200 lines. And knowing that it was not going to be easy to get people to read the 100 pages of dense poetry, I decided pretty early on, and also in response to some of my graduate work at Portland State, to create annotations, like a fictional annotation to the poem. So the poem is 100 pages, took a year. The annotations are 225 pages. It took me 4 years to write those. And of course, I was raising kids and we were living overseas, teaching overseas, so it took a while.
But the profane comedy is the umbrella for all of it?
Yeah, essentially. Those two things are the profane comedy. Three sections of the poem, which are essentially like Dante's architecture, Inferno, Purgatory, and Paradise become perdition.
And so it's all perdition. But you know, I have read it, and I must say that you take no prisoners. Yeah. I mean, you take on political icons and put them in the rings. Mm. There is a lot of human underbelly here, the worst of humankind. Mm. And is that because that you need to burn it clean? Why did you take on the worst things and commit them to art, to transcend, transform?
What Dante did was also, you know, casting well-respected leaders into, you know, the inferno and judging them and punishing them. And I felt like, if he could do it, I could do it. I think the main difference in the language is just I really went at it as a punk. Punk was a movement in art that really influenced me when I was 13 years old. And the idea was, nobody can do it better than you. If you do it and you get it done, then there it is. And, you know, who cares how it gets judged?
Amen, brother. But I'll tell you, yours got done with craft. I mean, there is not a lump under the mattress. That thing is as smooth as silk. But did you do a page a day? Did you just say, I'm going to do a page today and just grind it out?
Well, I'd have to go through my journals to see how I really did it, but it seems to me like the thing was scene by scene.
And so some
scenes ended up being quite long and took obviously more than a day, and some scenes maybe I got through pretty quickly. But the idea, the visuals was the new thing for me. I mean, I'd written for 20, 21 years before I sat down to write the Profane Comedy, and the visual aspect in my head was as clear as any that I had ever known as a writer. And so getting it out was actually not that hard. It just took time.
Oh, speaking of visuals, did your illustrator capture what you wanted?
Yes, yes. So I also, in response to understanding that people don't just want to read epic poetry, I asked a former student of mine who became a great artist in Seattle. His name is Seth Goodkind, and I highly recommend everybody look him up. Seth Goodkind, Push-Pull in Seattle. And he, I chose him because I had seen his line drawing, and he does very well. He is a historian himself, and he has a series of comics that he has written about the union movement, and right, all the abuse that union workers had to face just to get unions going. So he's like a historian keeping that stuff going in the form of cartoons. So I have Fing going through perdition, talking to Ronald Reagan, talking to Herbert Hoover, and that's history. And I want to convey, you know, in one drawn image, all that stuff that I'm putting into words. And yes, Seth did a marvelous job.
And they are representational cartoons. There's nothing really like it. And I have to say that you should be proud of. To do something for the first time, to do something for the second time is just okay. To do something for the first time is really to do something. And we can tell people the name of that, Perdition. They can get it at New Academia. Mm-hmm. I'll Google it. And through Amazon, right. Well, give us a little bit of it.
Okay, so here is the first 25 lines. You know, I think if you're familiar with Dante, you might catch some parallels. One's journey goes a certain distance when a path appears to be a web. To be content in such an instance would seem like halting the tidal ebb. There are so few means to one's assistance. The first step is the one we most dread. No single strand can support one's ambition. No direction appeals to curiosity. No reason can surmount the fearful vision that pride has positioned into apostasy. All around, the spiders of excision threaten to put cease to our velocity. Yet the duty to vocation reckons to propel us forward despite our wishes. One has no choice but to be beckoned and to taste the bitter as delicious.
Mm. My, so. What an entry. What an entry. So dramatic, so theatrical. Keep going.
Oh, okay.
What happens next?
Right. Let me see. I have a moment where they just approach the gateway to perdition. So Actually, yeah, I just want to say that at this point, Fing is with his guide, Abraham Lincoln, and like Virgil with Dante, he's going to guide him through, and they just getting through the gateway into perdition. So Lincoln is the he here. He convinced, and we proceeded along the thinnest strand of the web, which felt as if it were as wide as the open seas, and which reverberated with every step, in motion, but supporting our motion as well. I might have been the length of an insect quivering on the kissing breeze's swell, or the very wind itself. The path was set before us like the telling tolling of a bell. I followed, unbelieving of the import, but hungry for a good story to tell. I thought to summon up some witty retort, but by a strange misstep, my guide fell. I took his wrist and helped raise my consort. Quoth my uncle, good thing it wasn't a well.
Did the rhyme help you, or did it force you to say things you weren't going to say?
I also, along the punk lines, did not insist as I got through that every rhyme be perfect. English does not lend itself to rhyme. Robert Pinsky, who's another of my poetic heroes, translated Dante's Inferno. It's a wonderful translation. I think it helped me a lot in my sense of punk and muscular language.
Some slant rhyme. However, it's really very clean, very crisp.
I tried to get a lot of internal stuff, not just end rhyme.
And you don't reach. I mean, I don't feel it ever being forced. Not one line is forced. So you must have just channeled it. You must have just gone into the zone when you wrote this.
Yes, there was no question that I was in a zone. It was a critical moment in my life. I needed to sort through my own thinking. I needed to, you know, like Dante in the poem, I needed to face up to some realities and to, you know, to mature in all honesty.
After writing it, before we hear the last section, what did you learn about yourself?
Well, first I learned that I could do something epic and, you know, greater than I ever thought I would do.
So that's a biggie.
So what follows from that is confidence, right? There's nobody who can tell me that I'm not right or that I can't eat, you know, I can't do what I want to do. You know, I mean, it just, it made a big difference to me just in getting through, you know, my daily life, in all honesty.
Yes. But had it not been successful, you would have had a different outcome. I mean, you did a beautiful work of art, but yeah. I mean, a lot is riding on that if our self-esteem is there.
You know, I have to say, I wrote the Profane Comedy without any real close experience or thought about Buddhism. And so what I would say is that that poem prepared me for what I was going to encounter with Siddhartha. And so when he became my leader in that sense, I was very grateful that I was able to get to him, and that, you know, I don't want to be too, you know, faithful or spiritual about it, but that's
just, you can't be too spiritual. There's no way we can be too spiritual. That's what we're put on earth to be. But I think that the idea of this preparing you for a life of the mind and a better life of the heart is really interesting. But you said this, you wrote this years ago, and then you just published it last year.
Right. So again, Perdition is the first third of it. There's two other sections. And so someday I hope to get those published. But yeah, it took 20 years. Now, again, I kept going. I didn't stop. I didn't waste a lot of time trying to sell it. I kept doing stuff. I wrote a book of short stories as Y.S. Fing about D. Selby Fing. So to get back to the name, Y.S. Fing is the name that I write with now. D. Selby Fing is the author of The Profane Comedy, who, you know, is a fictional character, but who killed himself after he wrote The Profane Comedy. And Y.S. Fing is one of his sons. So I'm using that father and son dynamic also to kind of just open up all kinds of examination or psychological possibilities. And so
let's hear the, I do believe the father in literature is something we deal with almost every program. It is profoundly influential for most people's, most poets' lives. But let us hear another one, which I think goes into music.
That's correct. So I'm very looking forward to this one.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay. Here, Thing has been told several times before by Lincoln not to talk to the people that they are encountering. But for the third time, Thing has spoken out of turn. So I think I'll start there. This is Thing's mistake, the very first line. There are more who come after us. My guide, and that's Lincoln, who had undivided with his will a nation, interjected, "So we will be on our way, thank you." Sweating, he turned back into his office, that's Hoover, and more people took our places, and the line slithered, and we passed wordlessly through the door. My leader cast glances at me, which were withering. I remembered then what he had told me before, I should be listening and not blithering. And a vision blistered through my consciousness, a dream, as I perambulated, of this man being born a Kentuckian, and then to Missouri having emigrated, where masters and slaves were the lay of the land. I did see a nation devastated, and he had not spoken. Divided Union I scanned, where brothers kill brothers, with limbs amputated, war ceaseless between them, each of them damned to cursing revenge on the other, whose mother and sister were raped by the brother who will always avenge for the sins wrought upon him. Complete, I saw millions of maimed and raped and killed who might otherwise be of service as lovers, with soft hands, whose beards are anxiety-ridden, whose kisses might be shared as generously as the ballistics which ripped the forests to shreds. The man beside me was a savior, as venerably as the souls bayoneted, dying septic deaths in the fields and the cities of the land of liberty, but unique in manner and words and sense. My silence was now the only prerequisite.
And now we will hear a song rendered from this, right?
Right. And so Lincoln says, "You better be quiet." And so this song is called Silence.
Lincoln cast a glance that was withering. I remembered what he'd said, I should be listening and not blithering. Then I was in a dream. Well, Lincoln was born in Kentucky and moved to the slave state of Missouri. I saw the nation devastated, division across the land, where brothers kill brothers, with limbs amputated, war ceases between them, each one of them damned to cursing revenge on the other, whose mother and sister were raped by the brother who will always avenge himself for the sins wrought upon him. Complete, I saw millions maimed and killed. This man was a savior as venerably as the souls bayoneted, dying septic death in the fields and the cities of the land of liberty, but unique in manner and words and sense. So I must be silent. I have to be silent. I know. have to be silent.
This brings us to the subject of your band. It's called Microscopic
Microcosmic Examples.
So, and does it really exist?
Yeah, well, I mean,
off and on.
I exist, and I call us Microcosmic Examples. And really, there are a few people who have done enough for me where they're part of the Microcosmic Examples too. But no, we're not really a band at this point. Nothing would make me happier.
You teach us more than anything that we are allowed to do everything. And that is the beauty, that is the grace, that is the gift. I hope, I know you give your students. And we would love to end this program with a final poem.
Okay, this is a microcosmic example that led me to, you know, a macro consideration, which is really one of the great things about poetry. I'm sure you agree. We take small, minuscule, microcosmic things, and they lead us to, you know, the biggest considerations and the mystical awarenesses. So here's as good of an example as I can come up with. A Christmas tree is up on November 24th. Rockville Plaza, public library window, delivery trucks, engines, elder care buses, overcolored brick and traffic guidance tiling, like an old European town square, like a bird with a broken wing trying to fly. The power to resist the distraction is difficult to maintain against perpetual distortions. The line between faux and authentic no longer exists. Society's purpose is to organize itself in perpetuity, but the individual is free to disengage and engage at will, to participate and observe. Take pleasure in irony. Nothing is fixed in the accumulating mass of knowledge. We must fix ourselves among the ephemera and carry on in practice toward the truest self, who despairs of another 5 weeks of Christmas songs, yet enjoys a few, and endures darkening cold for the spring, which hopes eternal. Consciousness is the tremendous window of this library. Looking out upon the life flowing in the manufactured plaza, I see all, and it cannot sustain itself. We shall all be pilgrims and pioneers again someday soon. No one needs to be reminded of that. There's plenty of momentum in that direction as we approach Thanksgiving.
That is the voice of Y.S. Bing. And the thing we love most is that in his book, Perdition, the historical facts are accurate and the imagination is inside and outside the work. And in his own poetry, the philosophical meanings are ideas we will carry with us. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is brought to you by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the SciNipid Fund. I am Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.